This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Brad Meltzer. Hey, this is Josh with iFanboy.com, and I'm here today with Brad Meltzer. Hi, Brad.
Good to finally be speaking to you.
Yeah, we worked on this schedule for a little while, but it worked out. Luckily, you're a professional.
As opposed to all the other people you deal with that you've now insulted?
Well, you know, comics. I know a lot of people in comics, and they'd be like, yeah, no, he's not wrong. Which brings me to, there's a part. When I work with people who have, or when I talk to people who have worked with Chris Eliopoulos, we do a brief Chris Eliopoulos appreciation moment. I've done it with others, and because I believe he is one of the greatest guys, and I saw that you, out of all the cartoonists in the world that you could have chosen to work with, you started working on these great kids books with Chris. How did that come about?
You know, the honest truth is this: Twitter is a hellhole, but Twitter can also every once in a while bring happiness. And we met on Twitter. We just wound up following each other. I was doing the History Channel TV show. And we obviously, I knew his work. I loved his work. I'd bought Franklin Richards for my own kids. Mm-hmm. But what happened was we were just history nerds. He really is a huge history nut as much as I am. And my daughter was just wearing lots of, you know, shirts with princesses on them. And I said, you know, I want to make a new shirt for her. I said, Chris, can you draw a little cartoon Amelia Earhart for me? This is a favor, you know? And he's like, yeah. And he draws a little, like, little girl Amelia Earhart. And I put it on a t-shirt. I wrote, I'm Amelia Earhart on the bottom. And on the back of the shirt, I wrote, I know no bounds. And I made it for my daughter. And my daughter was like, her friend was like, I want one of those. My wife was like, I want to wear one of those. And I'm not joking. That's how the book series really got started. Because at one point we were like, okay, we don't know crap about making t-shirts, but we do know how to make books. And I asked Chris because, you know, listen, any cartoonist that works in comics, anyone who does comics can do cute, can do funny. The hardest thing to do is the heart. And what Chris Eliopoulos' superpower is he can just pull your heartstrings. And if you're going to do Abraham Lincoln and Rosa Parks and Dr. King and do a book series to give your kid better heroes, you better be able to draw heart. And so the whole I Am series, you know, was launched from that mutual love and nerdiness.
Oh, that's great. He's
also, by the way, I just have to say, like, the nicest person on the planet. And the best part is the more I say his name on here, the more he'll email me later and say, please don't talk about me. Don't mention me. You don't have to do that. And it's just fantastic that just even giving him this moment is going to hurt him. And so therefore I'm all for it.
I just do it because every once in a while he puts me in a book and I find that to be really fun. He named a Star Wars system after me.
That's the thing is, he hides me in every I Am book, right?
I've seen you. I've seen Joe Caramagna. I've seen them all.
Right. I was going to say, but he has like Eric Larson's in there. Yep. Like there's like some deep cuts in there that if you don't know comics and comic people, like everyone's looking for the 27 we hide in every book. We hide Superman in every book, unless you're a DC Comics lawyer, in which case that's totally not Superman or Clark Kent.
Of course not.
But we hide all this stuff in every single I Am Kids book, but no one's going to find all the comic book creator cameos that Chris has put in over the years.
So I guess working backwards a little bit, you have written, I'm reading up about your career, and there's a lot of different things. And so I'm not going to get to all those things, nor do you probably want to go through all them, but I'm wondering what their connection is, or if you found it moving into sort of doing the kids' books. It's not sequential art in the same way, but I'm wondering, you know, were they informed by your comics work that had come before them in a way, or sort of how did you decide to format those and build those?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for me, I know it sounds so silly, but everything is sequential art to me. It's just, it's how I tell my, you know, when I got hired on Green Arrow, when Kevin Smith was leaving all those years ago and no one was doing comics but Kevin and they wanted to fill someone in, they announced me and Bob Schreck was like, you're going to fail on a big stage, you're going to succeed on a big stage because it's our number one superhero book. And I was like, I'll take a shot. And he's like, no one's going to know who you are in comics. So they announced me as the thriller writer who was taking over Green Arrow. And someone went out and some comic reader, of course, was like, I read all of Brad Meltzer's novels, where I think three of them or four of them at the time. And he said, and I'm just telling you, everyone, like they read like comic books. There's a short chapter and then there's a cliffhanger and there's a short chapter and there's a cliffhanger. And the funny thing was, is it was news even to me. Mm-hmm. And I was like, huh? Like I was like, and to me, it's like that Mr. Miyagi thing. Like I was trained. That's what I loved were comics. And so I was trained reading 22 pages and a cliffhanger. And then I read another next month, 22 pages and a cliffhanger. So it just got drilled into me. It was like my, you know, waxing on and waxing off and painting the fence. Like it was just what was built into me. So I still, even when it comes to the thrillers or the kids books, or even the TV shows, like a commercial is just a cliffhanger to me. It's all I write, and you can see my scripts from Green Arrow and Justice League or Identity Crisis. And you look at the scripts that I do with Chris Eliopoulos for the I Am books, they're the exact same style, the exact same things. They're all, I actually never call them books. I call them comics that are in hardcover. That's it. There's no difference to me. It's just bigger panels. And you can see I'll break down, you know, six panel pages. I'll just do it and say, this is, you know, we're going to do a nine panel like Watchmen. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I got it. Let's go. So it just always has been informed that way.
So when you, you know, I would say that the first time that I was aware of you was probably when you took over Green Arrow. And I don't know if I think of you foremost as a comic book person, but I was looking at it. It wasn't really all that long of a period where you were sort of regularly writing stuff. Do you feel like you're still talking about it all the time, though? Because I feel like you're still very associated with comics. And I'm in the comics world, so that's how it's going to be. But
yeah, no. I mean, listen, I don't feel like I ever stopped writing. You know, I went... Yeah. I mean, I just have done a, it's weird because I did I did Green Arrow for 6 months and I did, you know, Identity Crisis, which, you know, took the better part of a year. I did a year on Justice League. You know, I did a big bunch on Buffy and then, you know, between Action Comics, Detective Comics 27, they let me redo Batman's first story, or Marvel 1000. Like I just, you know, I have another one that I'm working on right now. I just can't stay away from it because it's my love. You know, it's just the thing I love. So, and I know it's crazy. And we're celebrating like something like 15 years since Identity Crisis. And I'm still at all my book events. There are people that are buying it and bringing it for me to sign. You know, obviously it's many old copies, but like a ton of new ones that people just are like, this is the first book I read that got me into comics. And, you know, it's only like a year old. And I'm like, so it's, you know, I can't anticipate that. It's a sweet compliment, but maybe I'm just that guy who just wouldn't go away and I'm just lingering around the bar like a bad person.
Well, it's a fun place to be. So when you sort of moved into doing Green Arrow, had you attempted writing comic books before, like literally comic books, or was that sort of your first crack at a full on comic book script?
No, I literally wrote to like, right to that. Judd definitely sent me a script, I'm sure.
He'd been on Green Arrow for a few years at that point, right? Or Green Lantern, I mean.
No, he hadn't started. I was before him. He had been on Green Lantern, right. He had been Green Lantern. Yeah. I always knew he was taking over, but they always wanted me to go first because they wanted an unknown after Kevin Smith.
Huh.
Bob Schreck said to me, if we replace Kevin Smith, the number one writer in comics right now, with someone who's in comics, everyone will scream, where the hell is Kevin Smith?
Mm-hmm.
They said, but if we bring you, who no one knows because you write novels, everyone will go, why is DC taking their number one superhero book and giving it to a guy I don't know? They must know something I don't know. It was a total stunt. And he's like, that's what he said. He said, you'll fail on a big stage, you'll succeed on a big stage. Everyone's going to be looking at you. It's up to your writing. I'll take a shot, right?
And Phil Hester was still drawing it at that point.
The only thing I begged, when I started Green Arrow, I begged Phil Hester to stay, and I begged Matt Wagner to continue on covers, so it would be seamless. And the truth was, it was my fear of if they saw it was something new, everyone would dump it. And then Kevin, who's a sweet friend and I know for years now, did the nicest thing that anyone had ever done for me at that point in my career, is they announced me in the press release. And he said in the press release, it was something along the lines of like, I've read the book already and Meltzer, I can't wait to read more of it. It's great. And I hadn't even written the book yet. And Kevin was just like, just looking out for another guy who knows what it's like to have all the pressure on him and everybody looking.
Mm-hmm.
And that was friggin' amazingly generous. I thanked him on his own show about that and his own house about that. But I can't say it enough. He is just all class and amazing.
And did you, how did you find that adapting to sort of the sequential storytelling form? I mean, you go from writing novels where you're describing a ton of things, and you have perfect control over everything you see, to a completely different format. And it is in my mind that comic book scripts are some of the hardest to write in sort of that format, because your artists are all taking things in a different way and there's lots of different ways to interpret it. How did you adapt? And I say that with the idea that there have been a lot of novelists who are very well known outside of comics who have come into comics, dipped their toes, and left never to be heard from again. But your stuff is still talked about, even from the beginning, which is interesting.
No, and I appreciate that. I wish I could say, it was just easy and it all came naturally because I'm so good at this. It wasn't. It was, you have to take a hard look at yourself. And it was easy to write the story. I knew what the story was. I said to Bob Schreck at the time, he asked me to do the book. He waited in line at one of my events. He was the last person in line. And I'll never forget, he said to me, would you like to take over Green Arrow? Last person in line. And I said, looked up at him, I said, I've been waiting my whole life for someone to ask me that. Because I've been hiding comic references in my novels for over 20 years. Like, before comics were cool and everyone's like, oh, they're all great. I mean, if you look at my first novel, the Supreme Court justices on the Supreme Court are all named after the Watchmen. And only the super nerds were getting Osterman and Veet and all these other names. Like, they, no one knew back then what I was doing. Like, it was like, if you came up to me and said to me, I was like, okay, we're friends. You get what I love. Let's be, let's hang out together. Like, that was it. There was no internet even to tell anybody. And so you just had to catch it and get it.
Mm-hmm.
And Schreck asked me, and I said to him, listen, I'd love to do this for you. I said, but if I do it, I don't just want to do it so I can say I did it. I said, I only want to do it if I can come up with a good story. So give me a couple months and let me see if I can come up with a good story. And I called him from book tour. I remember I was backstage about to be announced on, and I was like, I got an idea. And I told him the idea. He's like, I like that. It was exactly what Archer's Quest wound up being. I was like, there's a guy at Oliver Queen's funeral after he's dead and there's a picture of him and we don't know who he is and this is what's going to do. And I told him the whole thing and he's like, write it up. And the hardest part of cracking the script was like, fine. That wasn't the hard part. The hard part was learning how to shut up. Because as a novelist, I paint the whole picture with words. Everything that you get to see, I have to pick some permutation of words to make you visually see what's happening on that page in the thriller. If someone's nervous, I got to say, he's tapping his leg. He's, playing with his keys, he's fiddling with his, biting his nails. I can figure out whatever I want to say to tell you he's nervous, but I got to tell you, I got to show you.
Mm-hmm.
And in comics, I don't got to say jack. I can literally say, in panel one, there's Superman, full shot, iconography of the big S, and you see his smiling face. Panel two, pulling closer on Superman. So we're just aiming toward the spit curl. Panel three, there's a bead of sweat rolling down Superman's forehead. Panel four, the bead of sweat, we're pulling in so tight on it, we're just on the bead of sweat. Panel five, we're so tight on the bead of sweat, we can see in the reflection of the bead of sweat who Superman is talking to. Mm-hmm. And I haven't said a single word, and you know Superman's nervous, right? Mm-hmm. I don't have to say a word. I can just let whoever it is draw it. And the super nerds will say, well, Superman doesn't sweat, and I would say the same. But I don't have to say anything. And that's what I had to learn to do is when I was, you know, when I wrote my first script, Phil Hester, I think, wanted to kill me because I described everything, the mm-hmm. angle, the layout of the page.
I was going to ask.
It's a worm's eye view looking up. It's a view from the top going down. Every panel I do the full description on. And then finally, Phil and I kind of learned, I learned to like, you know, he learned to basically do one thing, which is ignore my ass. Mm-hmm. And Rags Morales did the same. It's like you eventually have to get in that groove with your artist where they stop listening to you and they listen to you when they think you have a good idea. And if you don't have a good idea, they do their own thing. And those were the best pages have always come from. Mm-hmm.
Did you curb that response to do sort of the Alan Moore script pages in the beginning to sort of later, you know, let the artist do what the artist does?
You know, I'm still a pain in the ass. I would lie. I should say to you, I've learned so much in my years of doing this. No, like I'm still the person who over describes everything, but I definitely pull back, not as much as I used to. Mm-hmm. I don't do the full Alan Moore, but I can't help it. I'm a novelist. That's what I do. Like, but Chris and Elio Apos and I mean, we've done 19 books together in this series.
Wow.
Like we have a shorthand for each other. And it's always comics. Like, it'll literally be like, I'm trying to think of the most recent one. We were doing like Leonardo da Vinci. And I'm like, okay, I want him to be like, he's inventing lots of things in this panel. So I want like a Carmine Infantino, like After Effects. So you can see him going like in five different places. Like, and I don't have to say it's like the Flash. He knows. He's got it. I just write Infantino effect. And he's like, we know our mutual language of comics is what always informs these kids' books.
How do you get yourself in the space when you're doing a kid's book to keep it interesting enough and not too dry? You know, if you're a history nerd, then the dry stuff can be really interesting, but you've got to sort of pull back. You sort of start with a larger chunk and then whittle it down, which is a lot like comics. Now
yeah,
that I think about
you know,
it.
I mean, there's a looking for like the good nuggets is like the Supreme Court definition of pornography, mm-hmm. which is, you know, when you see it.
Yeah.
I know when I see the good story. And I know one thing, I've learned one thing over these, you know, years is I'm not that special. Mm-hmm. And if I like it, hopefully there are enough people out there who are just like me and they're going to like the same thing. And I think the only thing that I've been lucky enough to do is to have kind of the things that I've found, people have come with me and I appreciate that. Like I always feel like there's a we out there. There's like this journey of people who like that same stuff I like. Mm-hmm. And I know for people in comics, like we know what that's like. Like so many of us know what it's like to be the only person in your school who likes comics, except for maybe one other person, you know? And now we can all find each other on the internet, but many of us grew up and you couldn't find anybody. You had to go to the comic store to find somebody. And you were there on Fridays when it used to be Friday poll day. And we were there on Wednesday when they switched to Wednesday. Like, you know what it was like to try and find your people. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's a long-winded way of saying, like, that's what I look for. I look for those things that I like, and I just know there are other people who are like me who like that stuff. But it's hard. I mean, these are the most amazing heroes. But, like, you know, I can tell you I also learned in a very humbling way. I taught my daughter, you know, the whole series started with Amelia Earhart, and mm-hmm. I told my daughter, you know, isn't Amelia Earhart amazing? She flew across the Atlantic Ocean. And my daughter's like, big deal, Dad. Everyone flies across the Atlantic Ocean. But if I tell my daughter... I told her the story, and this is true, that Amelia Earhart, when she was 7 years old, built a homemade roller coaster in her backyard, that she took a wooden crate and put roller skating wheels in the bottom. She shoved it to the roof of her tool shed. She got up and climbed up onto the roof, gets in the crate, comes flying down the side, down these, you know, big giant pieces of wood and flies through the air. And that was the first moment Amelia Earhart ever flew. She was 7 years old. She said that feeling of her stomach bottoming out from under her, she wanted that feeling back again. And now my daughter's like, Dad, tell me more about that person. Mm-hmm. And I just got dumb lucky that my daughter was like, that's what I like. And that's what we realized, like, you know, no one cares about what year they won the battle of blank, whatever it is. But what we care about are those moments where they're just like us mm-hmm. and the human moments. And that's what I don't ever care about. They signed this, you know, document on such and such date, and then they passed this law. And so, who cares? Nobody cares. but you find out that Abraham Lincoln loved turtles and loved animals, or that, you know, Amelia Earhart built a homemade roller coaster, or that, you know, Jackie Robinson got into a rock fight with, you know, a family across the street when he lost his temper as a little kid. And suddenly these people who were these magnificent, and same thing with superheroes, you know, these big kind of lowercase g gods that we build these statues to and worship at them, you know, it's silly. Like the best part is actually that they're all like us.
Yeah.
Those are the moments I always go for. I always go for the human moment, and not because I'm like, it's marketing or a thought or that's what people are going to like. It's just what I think is more interesting. I don't care about any of the other parts. They're boring to me. I care about those moments where they were scared and they were terrified and they were just like us.
So what were your favorite comics when you were growing? Like, what are the things that really spoke to you? Like, for a lot of people, especially a while ago, kids read comics. Everybody did. But there were certain of us who, you know, read something and went, oh, this is really speaking to me. And then there's a moment where you realize, oh, this is an art form that is more than the sum of its parts. You know, was there a book that sort of stuck out to you where, you know, that made an impact on you to make you stick with it for longer, to be more involved with comics in your life?
Yeah, I mean, listen, Justice League was it. That was the first one. That was like the thing that made me lose. I mean, it was my first comic that I ever got as a gift was a Marshall Rogers Englehart Batman Detective Comics. It was the Laughing Fish Joker cover.
Yep.
Where the Joker has those like laughing fish, and it just scared the crap out of me. I was too young. I had to be like, I looked at the math on it. I was like 6 or 7 years old. It just scared the piss out of me. And I never read it. I had it, but I never read it. But the first comic I ever read was Justice League of America 150. It was at 150, so it was like a big, you know, kind of like, yeah, like it seemed like a bigger issue back then. All the 50s and 100 issues were big. And it was the Justice League was fighting the Key, and the villain, the Key. And there's this one page that I remember looking at, and they're all in these kind of key-shaped prisons, like keyholes. So Superman's standing in a giant oversized keyhole, all kind of super Silver Agey stuff, like, and, you know, and Flash is in a giant keyhole, and Elongated Man is in a giant keyhole. Their powers don't work on any of their prisons. So like your Green Lantern's was yellow, and Flash's vibrated at a difference, so he couldn't get speed. And I was like, I remember thinking, oh my God, how are they going to get out of that? And the way that they got out of it was, and again, like, just look at like the history of it, like the Elongated Man, Ralph can't get out of his, but he can move over, or no, Flash can't run is what it is. Flash can't run out, but he can vibrate to someone else's. So he vibrates over to Ralph. Ralph can't stretch out, but he can form into a, like a giant, like rubber band. So he becomes the floor of what becomes a cosmic treadmill for the Flash. And basically, Green Lantern has to like get them over, uses his ring, not on him, but on them. And anyway, they start running. And how do they get out? They work together. Mm-hmm. That's the answer. You work together. You stand together. That's how you get out. You are all weak in one way, but together. And I remember just as a 9-year-old kid, my mind was blown. That was it. I went in every Justice League forward from there. I started trying to buy. I didn't have much money, but the comic store back then, it was just a bookstore that had comics too, was you can get a 25 cents a comic, or you can get five for a dollar. And I would get a $5 allowance every week, and I would go down to the comic store, and I would say, here's my $5, and I would take my books back, and I would just – but the one – And that's where I started it. But
sure,
the one that really made me go like, this is an art form was Marv Wolfman and George Perez's Teen Titans. Mm-hmm. And that was where I was like, I missed it. When it came out, I just missed it. I remember saving $5 to buy the first issue. I had to save up to buy it. And I remember thinking that was more money than I ever had in my entire life. It was a full $5. I'm sorry, $15 to buy the first issue. It was DC Comics Presents 26 and Teen Titans 1, and it was $15 each for each one. It took me like, I couldn't tell you, like, it felt like forever to get it. But that's when I remember being like, these are characters with depth, and they have backgrounds, and they have loves for each other, and they were human. They weren't superheroes, but they were human. And that is the most influential thing, those two books on me, along with Legion of Superheroes. And then, of course, the whole cascade comes, right? You get X-Men, you get Avengers, you get...
Yeah.
You know, and then you start following people. Like, I remember being like, George Perez brought me over to Avengers and Justice League together. I was like, this guy is amazing. What's he doing? He's the same guy, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, realizing Marv Wolfman was a name that was a writer. He wrote on this book. And man, I like this guy, Len Wein. He seems, I like his stuff too. And just finding, you know, whether it was Keith Giffen and Paul Levitz on Legion or, you know, that's who I just started. And then obviously John Byrne and Claremont on, you know, on Fantastic Four and X-Men. But those are the books that just kind of unlocked it all.
When you started making comic books professionally, was there anything that you learned about the craft that made you appreciate it in a different way or sort of approach how you read them?
Those are two questions and I'll answer. Let me give you both. So sure. The first one is definitely like just the sheer kind of the last one first is like, you know, just the ridiculous things you don't think about, like, right. Like big crowd scenes are a pain in the ass to draw and this artist may not want to draw it. Right. And you're like, what do you mean? That you just dream up whatever you want and it'll be done.
Horses.
You realize that like, right. Whatever you want. Right. Like, and you know, and then there's also less like fun things. Like when I work with Ed Benes on Justice League, Ed Benes just loves drawing women's asses. He loves it. I can't, you know, he just does. He's good at it. That's what he does. That's his magical move. But I don't want to have women's asses drawn every scene. So I would like in the script, keep writing like, and then Wonder Woman comes in, do not draw her ass here. Like, and then Black Canary comes in, don't draw her butt here. Do not. Like, we don't want a butt shot here. And, you know, you just learn what people do and what they, you know, and you're trying to like, that's just hysterical to me. And then to your first question, I think what I also really learned is just, again, the humbling side of it. And I will give full credit to Rags Morales on Identity Crisis. It was the big moment where Sue Dibney is found dead by Ralph. And I just had written like, you know, half a page describing how it should be, a camera on the floor, worm's eye view looking up. So we feel Ralph so towering over us and Sue in his arms. And I had this kind of like extreme version of like Supergirl's, you know, Justice League 7 cover. I mean, Christ on Infinite Earths cover, like cradling Supergirl's dead body. Like I had all this envision in my head. And Rag said to me, this was, you know, listen, how about I draw it my way? And if you don't like it, I'll draw it your way. And I was like, of course, whatever, give it a shot. And back then it was, there were no JPEG. It was just, you come through your fax machine. And so I was standing by my fax machine and his version came through and it was from the camera up top, looking down at Ralph and Sue. And I saw the picture and I called him up and I said, your way. Mm-hmm. And I just learned right there, like, you know, you're working with professionals and DC has always given me and Marvel too, the best artists that exist in comics. And you learn to just shut up and let them do what they do. Cause they don't need your, you know, your jibber jabber.
Did your idea of who sort of your favorite artists or the most talented artists kind of change? And I'm not asking you to name names. I used to like so-and-so, but now I like, but I found that the more that I've learned about comics, the more I appreciate the small, like I can say that there's pinup guys and then there's storytelling guys. And I love storytelling guys. I think somebody like a Stuart Immonen or something is just, he's the most amazing storyteller. And that's sort of one of the things that I always, there's a lot of little things like that, but it's the part of the craft that I love.
Stuart Immonen, I don't think in his Legion days, I ever appreciated him as much as I did in his later Marvel work.
Yeah.
Like he definitely became, that's actually the perfect person. You know, the big people that I always loved, I still love,
sure.
You know, I just do. I always will. I mean, if you look at Justice League Zero, we did this Zero issue and it was one page was a different, I wanted a different artist on every page and each one was a different kind of era. And obviously we hired the era from where they were, but I also, in between each era, we would flash forward to things that hadn't happened yet. And you can see who I loved, whether it was Tony Harris, whether it was Jim Lee. I mean, these are not hard, you know, there's no bold person saying, oh, I like Jim Lee. Like, no shit, join the club. You know, but you can see in there who I love. And, you know, and it's a list from, you know, Gene Ha or, I mean, anyone that's in that book was who I loved at the time. That was just, those are my favorites. And they're still my favorites. Like,
Gene
Ha
is the best.
I've worked with him. I won an Eisner Award with him,
sure.
Like, thanks to him. But anything I can do, like Gene Ha is just and in fact, he's the person, this is what I appreciate. Here's the better answer to your question. I was sitting with Gene Ha for dinner. He came to Florida and we go out to dinner and I work with him on multiple books, but I'd never met him face to face. And he says to me, as we're sitting through dinner, just as we're kind of getting to the end of it, he says, you know, I'm so happy that I finally got to meet you face to face. It tells me so much more about you. And I was like, what are you talking about? I know you this whole time. And I realized, and he goes and he starts listing all these physical things that I do that I don't realize I do. And it taught me in that moment, he sees the world as an artist differently than I see the world as a writer. Like, he just physically sees different things. And Chip Kidd is the same way, great graphic designer who people know from, you know, the Jurassic Park logo to my first two books. I mean, I've worked with him on Batman and other things. But Chip sees the world differently. Like, you and I see a stop sign, and it's a big red, you know, octagon with, you know, the letters STOP in it. And Chip Kidd looks at that same exact thing and sees the greatest representation of graphic design ever created that in any language can tell you what to do. He just views it differently. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've learned about artists, is like, they look like their art. They act like their art. They become it in a way that when you get to know them, it completely informs, like, how they can do what they do. And the big ones are, you know, this will be a gross generalization, but, you know, some of the biggest ones that are great at the splash page just have big personalities. They just do. And, you know, the quiet ones, like Gene Ha, is just a quiet guy, but man, he will painstakingly work on a tiny little 9-panel grid like nobody's business and have details in it you will never, ever, could have never been in your script, but he will pull out.
I've never gotten that answer before. That's a good answer.
You know, but it's true.
Yeah. Looking back at Identity Crisis, I think we're living in a different world than the one that we were when it came out. It's pretty hardcore. It's pretty raw. It's definitely taking after the sort of comics as a dark place, you know, that you know, started in 86, really, and kind of permeated throughout. Do you think you would approach that the same way today? And you know, you've also probably changed a lot during that time. You've had kids, you've done through a bunch of things. Like, would you see comic books in the same way that you tell a story like that?
Yeah, listen, I can't possibly, nor do I ever want to, go back and redo my own work.
Sure.
Right? I always will, to a stubborn level, stand behind what I put out there. It's like, that's what I had to say at the time. However, as someone smarter than me once said, anytime someone says, I don't like something you did, I can't help but say, maybe they're right. Mm-hmm. I can't help it. You know, I just do. I feel like that's how you get better as an artist, is like, you have to take the negative, as not just take the positives. You know, so do I think we could have pulled off that, you know, a storyline that had a rape like that in it? Like, it's a different world we live in. Okay. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, I wish rape did not exist in our culture. But to say that our medium can't deal with the issue or can't ever approach it or talk about it is to limit our entire medium. And I still believe that. I feel like you have to take the hardest issues, and whether it's, you know, a great comedian or a great artist or a great writer or a great painter or anyone, like, the job is to take the ugliest parts of us and kind of make us look at them and try and understand them, even when we hate them. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated question you're asking.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, like, it just is. But, you know, I just feel like the one thing we should never do is limit what the medium can tackle. Mm-hmm. I just don't, I'll never be in favor of that. But, you know, I have to look at it and say, you know, listen, it's still the number one thing that, you know, you'll have people who hate it and people who will come up to me and say, go on Twitter. In fact, today on Twitter, nearly every single day on Twitter, there is someone who tweets at me and says, this book, Identity Crisis, is the reason I read comics today. So I know that there's negative out there. I know that there's positive out there. I don't think for one second that all the positive are right. I don't think for one second, you know, I learned early on in my career, you know, just because someone says something great about you doesn't mean you're great. And just because they say it's terrible doesn't mean you're terrible. Like, the worst thing my agent once said to me was that anyone can say about you is, it was okay. You know, like, that you had no impact on someone. So to me, you know, I'm still trying to, you know, find whatever truth I can in it, but it clearly hit people in some places. And I think that as a culture, you know, I think the best comics today are the ones that are hitting our cultural sweet spots. You know, mm-hmm. they just are. And back then, I think we were dealing a lot after 9/11 with fear, mm-hmm. and whether our heroes were going to be strong enough and what was going to happen to those we love the most. That was just a big issue back then. We just watched 9/11 happen, and we started worrying about everyone around us. At any moment, they could be gone. That's what identity crisis was always the heart of it was Dan DiDio coming to me and saying, after 9/11, you know, we were scared about people in uniform. We need that feeling back again. And can you give it to us? And that's what we were after. I mean, I think what Tom King has done with Mr. Miracle as just an example, like mm-hmm. as one thing that I think is perfectly speaks about the culture. We're a culture of just real anxiety right now. We're a culture that is battling like anger and divisiveness and even battling over what's real and what's not real. It's the perfect book for the time, mm-hmm. right? It speaks to those issues, and it has a lot of, you know, amazing things in it. And I think that those, you know, we always want to have art that tackles where we are as a culture.
Mm-hmm. So you're still reading current stuff, it sounds like.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, it's easy because I'm on the comp list, but
sure.
I mean, you could never, even if I wasn't, I still have a pull list for whatever I'm not on the comp list for at my comic store. I still go, you know, I wind up, you know, you can't keep me away. I can't, it's what I love to read.
Mm-hmm. Say anything. What's blown you away over the past couple of years? Like what's been sort of some of the greatest comics you've read?
Well, my favorite, let's see, what have I read that I really love? I love Mr. Miracle, as you can tell by that.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Tom's, you know, the world of him, I think his Batman is the defining Batman of, you know, no one's touching it. It's fantastic. I love the obvious things. So like I still love anytime Brian Vaughn, you know, listen, Brian's a pal, but I still love Saga. I'm still pissed and I want him to come back to it every month. I can't help it, you know? Cause I think that Fiona Staples is like, does magic on a page. Like, I just can't wait to see it. But I love book. What is it? It's Xander Cannon's book. It's like, I'm always gonna pronounce it wrong. I'll never remember it. It's, about the monsters on the island. You read that
I
book?
Can't think of it. No,
it's like
I know.
Hold on. I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly. And then I'm going to be really bad. It's called, Kaiju Max. Kaiju
okay.
Max.
Right.
I love that
right.
book. Right. It's like a monster. It's like Oz meets like Godzilla monsters, like mm-hmm. all these monsters on islands on a prison. And he's doing like Oz instead of doing, you know, Japanese monsters. That's a really dark, awesome book. What else am I loving? You know what I love right now? I love Matt Fraction's Jimmy Olsen.
It's so good.
I love that book. That
it's
book is
so good.
Fun. It is so like, I was like, Jimmy Olsen, really? Is that going to be fun? Like, I love that book. I can't wait, obviously, for Bendis's Legion. You know,
yeah.
I know, like, I can't, I'm a Legion nut. I can't wait. You know, I read obviously everything. I mean, you name it, I read it, but
yeah.
Trying to think what's really blown me away. Oh, I love, I never pronounced his name right, Jeff Lemire.
That's right.
Black Hammer. I love that book. That book is friggin' amazing. and I like Mark Miller. I still like Magic Order. I think, you know, as with everything, there are titles you like better than others, but I thought Magic Order was like as, you know, as good as he's done in so long.
Yeah. He went on a real good run. Over the past big chunk of years. Like his comics have been great.
I think Netflix can, you know, that could have easily gone the other way and been like, okay, I can just phone it in now. And he found another gear.
Yeah. 100%.
So I like that. What else do I really love? I mean, I love Judd's Hilo. I think, you know, if you're looking for something for your kids, like, listen, I'd love you to read I Am Walt Disney, but Hilo is freaking amazing.
My kids read both, so it's fine.
There you go. Yeah, no, that's good.
So,
I Am Walt Disney is dedicated to Judd.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I've had Judd on here. I've had Chris. I've had all of them. So, no, I like Judd a lot as a person, as I'm sure you do as well. I guess as we wrap this up, because I know that you've got to get going. You know, I know the way that that Bob Schreck approached you was probably not expected, but was it in your plan to write comics or did you hope that to be a thing or did it sort of, that'd be cool, but it came out of the blue, you know, did you aspire to it?
You know, the funny thing was, is back, not to go all old man on it, but like back then in those olden days, like you stayed in your lane. You were supposed to stay in your lane, right? Like if you wrote thrillers, you wrote thrillers the rest of your life. And if you wrote comics, you wrote comics the rest of your life. If you wrote movies, you wrote movies the rest of your life. Like you know, I remember when what was his name? The guy who wrote the Dark Knight screenplay, the original, not Dark Knight, the original Batman movie. What was his name? Bob.
He writes all the movies now.
Right, right.
He co-wrote Starman.
I'm trying to think. I'm blanking on his name.
Two men in their 40s can't figure out words.
I know. I can't do it. But anyway.
Everybody listening knows who we mean.
The screenwriter, everyone listening is now like, I know they're screaming at the thing. I know. But the guy, the screenwriter of Tim Burton's Batman movie, I remember came and wrote like an issue of Batman. And we were like, what? Mm-hmm. He's a screenwriter and he's going to come and down to us and deal with us regular people. This is going to be the best issue ever. You know, and I don't think that was like, you know, that it was a one-time thing. And so I never thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to write comics. I can't wait to write comics. I just didn't know if I was going to be able to. And I remember when Shrek asked me, I immediately said yes. And all the novel people and all the writers were like, why are you doing that? Why are you slumming in comics? Mm-hmm. And I was like, go fuck yourself, man. This is the best medium of all. And I remember they announced it at Book Expo. And I was on a panel with Walter Mosley and Janet Ivanovich, like two far bigger writers than mm-hmm. me. It was like my start of my career. They were on the panel. I was like, how did I get on this panel? And they announced it in my intro, like right there at the event. And I remember Janet Ivanovich leaned over to me and said, oh man, I really like Wonder Woman. And then Walter Mosley leaned over to me and said, Green Arrow, man, does he still have Speedy? And I realized in that moment that it was like, there was this entire underground of people that all loved the crap we loved at the level we loved it. And suddenly I became like any novelist that, you know, a lot of them, I can't take credit for all of them, but like, especially in those early years that wrote comics, it was because they were coming to me and I was secretly bringing them to DC and Marvel and making introductions. Cause I was like, listen, I was like the drug dealer. I was like, first one's free and then you know where to come for the rest, you know? And like, I would just make connections cause I wanted everyone to do it. And that was how I got into television, is they were like, you know, novelists and comic writers didn't do their own history television shows for the History Channel. But I was like, why not? Why can't I? And they said yes, so I tried. So now you see a lot more jumping, but you know, back then you just didn't think of it. It just wasn't, I obviously wanted to. When I met Shrek, I was like, I would talk comics with him. I met him at Judd's wedding. We talked comics to no end. But
Shrek is like one of the best talent. Now. He's like one of the best talent finders that I've known in comics.
He's,
if you think of all the people,
he,
totally.
Yeah, he's one of the.
But he brought all of these great people. It's amazing.
Staggering.
Yeah, totally. All right. Well, I know that you have to get going. Thanks so much for taking the time,
man. No, I appreciate it. And let me just also say, I just want to thank every person in comics who has kind of like jumped over. I can't tell you how many people are like, listen, man, I don't really read novels, but I gave the book Elias mm-hmm. a shot because it was about the creation of Superman, or I gave the Escape Artist a shot, or I read it to my, I now buy the kids' books, or I watch the show. Like the comic book reader, you know, all of us who grew up in that way, we are among the most loyal people on the whole planet. And I hope you know that loyalty goes back right to you. And just want to say thank you to every single person who supported us, whatever, whether it's the thrillers or whether it's the nonfiction or whether it's the kids' books. It means more than I can ever express. So thanks for that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, brother.
And that wraps up another Talksplode. I know this one was a little bit late, but I hope it was worth the wait for everybody. I want to thank Brad, obviously, for taking the time. I don't have to tell you, he's a pretty busy guy with a packed schedule, and I really enjoy talking to him. You can go to bradmeltzer.com. You can go to twitter.com/bradmeltzer and find him in those ways. And, of course, you can go to ifanboy.com, and you can find more of our shows, more of our podcasts, all of the other interviews that I have done in the past, and other people have done, too, because I'm not the only one who's done them for ifanboy.com. And thanks again to the patrons for making this show possible. And you can do that at patreon.com/ifanboy if you want to get involved with those things. Thank you very much. Talk to you later. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.